First thing I want to do is say thank you for inviting me here. I've spent the day listening, and while AFTRS is, I guess, nominally a government agency, it's filled with art freaks and professional filmmakers. So although I am in the middle when I'm at AFTRS and I find things pop up on Lotus Notes for meetings that I never planned and don't know what they're going on, after what I just heard, my God, I feel for you folks. So, well, the first thing I want to do is to reflect a little bit on some of the things that I've been hearing today. And I got a massive sort of epiphany today when I realized something has happened. A penny has dropped, and we're just starting to hear the sound of that penny. I was in America a few weeks ago, and when I was in Los Angeles, which is where I lived before I moved to Sydney, I found out that An Inconvenient Truth, which is the new Al Gore film, was playing. It was only playing in two theaters in America. One of them was in LA. It's my favorite theater, the Arclight. So I called a friend and we went over and we went to see it. And I realized in watching that film, it was completely full showing. It was late at night. The showings had been full. It made an enormous amount of money for being in two theaters that weekend. I realized that what had happened is that everything that we'd been talking about, the scientists have been warning about, global warming, this, that, the other thing, all of a sudden, bam, it has become a trend. It's not just this little voiceover on the sideline, but now all of a sudden, it's center stage. And what I kept on hearing from all of the speakers this morning and this afternoon is that this idea that the environment and that climate change and that we're responsible and that we've got to fix it, it's no longer something that's on the sidelines. And it seems, if you go in your Wayback Machine to just 6 months ago, we weren't talking in these terms. And maybe even 2 months ago, we weren't talking in these terms. And all of a sudden, all of us are just like, yeah, well, that's pretty much it. And that's an enormous thing, because this is, as bureaucrats, and it's not a dirty word, but defining what you do, this is going to set your agenda and this is going to set your goals for the rest of your careers. It's now becoming a principal feature of what all of the people of Queensland are going to look to you to do, because only the government is big enough to take on a problem this big. Now, I'm going to talk about participation in the context of the fact that you will not be doing this alone, but when it comes to looking at a center point, they're going to look to you to lead. And the other trend, which sort of fits into this, is I kept on hearing the words sustainability and livability, that growth is no longer enough. And maybe this is yet another phrase and yet another fragment of this entire sea change, that it's not as though we've all gone green so much as we've started to understand, in a broader sense, another thing that I've been hearing is a lot of systems thinking, that things are really big, they're really complicated, that they're almost unknowable, and yet at the same time we're getting a clear sense that there are pieces, they fit together in a really complex way, and that we can use at least the awareness of that to help guide our own actions, that we're going to try to think through the consequences of our actions in a broad sense, not just ecologically, but also economically, also sociologically, all the different things that we're actually starting to carry around inside of our own heads, this idea that there's a bigger thing out there and that we have an effect on it. And another thing that I keep on hearing, and I think this is really the subtext today, is that change has become the norm, that this is not your father's government, as it were, that in fact the world that you're living in, and I will deal with this directly, is being confronted by so many different forces which are pulling it in so many different directions, that the institutions as we understand them are starting to change dramatically because of that pressure toward change. Now, this morning and just this afternoon, and by the way, never follow a politician on stage. Man. There's been a lot of beating up on postmodernism this morning, and we just witnessed a lot of beating up on the middle. And it's interesting because I had to study postmodern philosophy as part of my normal discourse in art. In postmodern philosophy, the middle is considered to be the best place to be, because the middle is where you have the most freedom of movement. The middle is where things are always going fast enough. The middle means you're not attached to the bottom and you're not clinging to the top. So you've got to consider that for everything that may be wrong with being in the middle is giving you, in an absolute sense, the most flexibility of action. I'll weave in some other themes as I go through my talk. But my task today is to take a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about and to frame it in the context of participation. Participation is a trend. It's a trend that is going to influence all of your work for all the rest of your careers. So let's start talking about what participation is. I want to break this talk up into an exploration, sociology, anthropology, whatever you want to call it. It's always good if we can start off with a basic foundation understanding of what participation is, then how it's been changing, and then how it's going to change your lives. So, part one, grooming rituals. Consider the chimpanzee. Chimpanzees and humans, as you know, share a common genetic heritage, unless you believe in intelligent design. And according to the most recent scientific findings, because now we've sequenced the genomes of people and we sequenced the genomes of chimpanzees, and the scientists are looking at them side by side, and the recent thing that they found out that they announced last month was that apparently, even after the species were distinct, there was still some hanky-panky going on. And so, as recently as 4 million years ago, we were getting some chimpanzee DNA and they were getting some human DNA. So we know that they're about 98% in terms of their DNA similar to human beings. There is one major difference which was identified about 6 months ago. Chimpanzees have jaws that are about 10 times stronger than human beings. The chimpanzee bites you, you lose the finger. That's it. Very hard for a human being to do that. Well, that's a plus, but there's also a minus, because the same gene that makes a really strong protein to keep their jaws very, very strong also makes it impossible for their skulls to grow. So we got the big brains, and they got the strong jaws. Well, okay, we got this big brain. What's it for? Well, it's art, philosophy, technology. You'd think that that's, you know, what we do with our brains all the time. We gossip. All right. And this is something that we share with chimpanzees, because we've now studied chimpanzee troops enough to understand that chimpanzees have heroes, and chimpanzees essentially do run around and gossip about each other, just the same way that human beings do. Now, why do both species share this quality? Well, both of these species are really almost defined by the incredible sociability of their species. And anthropologists have been looking at the sociability of human species for 100, 150 years. And recently, they've started to cohere this entire study into an area called social networks. Now, when a lot of us hear social networks these days, we think MySpace and perhaps 15-year-old and being lured away to do evil things. That's not what we mean when we're talking about social networks. What we're talking about with the social network is that we're using all of this nice gray matter up here to actually sort of hold a mental model of all of the people that we regard as our closest social contacts. So that's our family, that's our friends, it's the people we work with. And we actually sort of have this little image of them upstairs, so much so that we can interact with that image to predict how that person is going to behave or not behave. And chimpanzees can do the same thing. We now know this. But again, because chimpanzees have less gray matter than we do, they can only do it with about 30 chimpanzees at a time. That's the average size of a chimpanzee troop. Human beings can do it with 150, and that turns out that that's the average size of a tribe. It just sort of works out that way naturally, because when you get beyond that number is called the Dunbar limit. It just becomes impossible to sort of keep all of the human interactions in your head, and so the tribe divides. Now, social networks are important because the thing that they do is they give us our place within a culture and they give us our status. And this has been realized in very real terms because psychologists and developmental psychologists are looking now at young women, about 11, 12, 13 years old, about the age when they go insane. And the reason they go insane, I had a lot more sympathy for them afterward, is because women spend a lot more time maturing their sense of social networks than men do. Men are only sort of dimly aware of the social networks that they carry around inside of them, whereas women actually experience a depth in that social network, which leads to all sorts of cliquishness and clannishness and sort of all that internecine warfare as they're juggling to be the top person. Well, the rest of our lives are still sort of spent in that struggle. And so we seek to, in our social behavior, reinforce all of our social relationships. And we do that, the principal act of reinforcement of social relationships and social networks is by participation. So when chimpanzees participate, they groom each other. This is an important point because a chimpanzee troop maintains its bonding one to another by common acts of grooming. Chimpanzees squabble, they fight, and the fights don't really ever get severely violent, but even when they fight over a mate or over food or something like this, immediately after the fight, there's grooming between the people who have fought, from the chimpanzees who have fought, because this reestablishes the social relationships, which are at the very, very bedrock. And they basically tell the chimpanzees through this act of social reassurance that this is where you belong. It's a reminder. And of course, humans participate in these rituals as well. Now, for example, there's a culture within America known as the Amish. You may or may not know about it. Peter Weir made a film called Witness several years ago, which details the Amish. And the Amish have essentially, not in an absolute sense, but in a broad sense, opted out of modern culture to preserve their own culture. And they aren't anti-technological, but they're very reluctant to adopt a technology because what they'll do is they'll spend a long time analyzing the social impact of that technology on their culture. So, for example, they'll use the telephone, but they'll keep the telephone in a booth a kilometer away from the house so that the telephone doesn't interfere with the life of the home. So the Amish practice that very quintessential participatory act of barn raising. When one of the Amish wants to build a house in their barn, they put the word out through their social network, and Amish communities are essentially identical to social networks. All the Amish will show up, the women will cook and do whatever, the men will do hammers and raise up, and generally they'll put up an entire barn in 24 hours just by doing that. The Amish know who they are. They participate in the rituals of their community, and by that they know who they are. And we all have those rituals. All I'd have to do is say, Aussie, 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 oi, 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 and you'd know what I'm talking about. We have rituals of participation, we have rituals of belonging. But something very interesting. The Amish sort of left the stream before the Industrial Revolution. The rest of us have been carried along into the industrial and now the post-industrial era. With industrialization, you got increasing specialization. So that it became progressively more difficult for an individual to participate broadly in culture because all of the roles in that culture became progressively more and more specialized. So the individual finds themselves with fewer and fewer opportunities to participate broadly in culture. And that has some very nasty side effects. You'll get an isolation in the individual because the individual is unable to essentially groom in their social network, which will lead to a sense of disconnection. And of course, if you're embedded in a culture where people are basically, because of their highly specialized tasks, doing things for you that in an earlier era you did for yourself or did through participation in that culture, you're going to learn helplessness. You're going to learn to be passive in the face of that. And so these are the artifacts of industrialization. The good, the bad, they're different. They simply mean that the way that we're relating to each other vis-a-vis participation in the industrial era were completely different to the forms that preceded it. And where we can't participate, we become very passive and we probably also become resentful. And to illustrate by way of an example, this is known to be particularly true in medicine. If, for example, God forbid, you were diagnosed with cancer, you could simply hand your fate over to your oncologist and pray for the best. And people who do that generally don't have great outcomes. Or you can become fully invested and say, you know, I'm not just the patient here, I'm not just the body lying on this table letting people do things to it, but I am participating in the search for the cure to my disease. And people who do that tend to have much better outcomes. Now, I'm involved with the Smart Internet CRC, which runs all over Australia. One of the projects that I know about is taking place in Tasmania through the University of Tasmania. And there's a doctor there who is just absolutely brilliant, who's realized that he has a bunch of patients with COPD, which is a congestive heart lung failure. It's basically the last stage of emphysema. As he said to me when he explained it to me, he said, Mark, you don't ever want to get this. And the patient outcomes aren't good. They're gradually dying. But generally what happens is they die because of some crisis that lands them in the hospital. They have these crises because they aren't monitoring their situation closely enough. And they aren't monitoring their own personal situation closely enough because they haven't been given the tools and the learning to help them monitor their situation closely enough. So really all he's been doing with them has been giving them an internet connection, which, you know, are practically free in Tasmania because they're very well wired there. And a nurse checks in with them every day about their symptoms, so that the patients are now learning how to monitor their own symptoms so they can catch something and maybe go in for a little bit of treatment for it before it becomes critical. And already these people are living longer and much healthier lives, so they're decreasing the amount of stress they're putting on the healthcare system in Tasmania. They're living better lives. It's a win-win, and all they've done there is made the patient an active participant in the process of healing. Well, that's the beginning of what I want to start to talk about. So, as I was flying around the world this month, I bought books and books and books, and one of the books that I bought was Krakatoa, which is a book that was published in 2002 about Krakatoa. And one of the points that it makes at enormous length was that Krakatoa had a smaller explosion in May, and it blew up at the end of August. The smaller explosion in May was reported in the Times of London 24 hours after it had happened. And this was the first time that any sort of major geological event had basically been reported instantaneously around the world. And that's because they had just laid a telegraph line to Batavia, because they had to lay a telegraph line to Darwin, because they had to lay a telegraph line to Adelaide, so that the Sydney Stock Exchange and the London Stock Exchange could talk to each other. And of course, it was also important for other reasons. Lloyd's of London need to know about the insurance rates, because there was a lot of shipping passing through all of those lands. And of course, as anyone who's worked with information about markets knows, there's an enormous public drive to get that information. And so once the telegraph came around, within 30 years, the commercial drive to get fresh information that you could make the deal on was so powerful that 30 years after the telegraph sends its first message, it's covered the entire planet. And it covered the entire planet with what some people have called the Victorian Internet. It was expensive and not quite as fast as the internet we have today, but it wasn't fundamentally different than the internet we have today. You can get a message anywhere you want instantaneously by yourself. You walk into the telegraph office. How is that different from what we have today? And it changed war, because the American Civil War was the first war that was fought by telegraph and railroad. And it laid down the archetype for how wars were fought through to the end of the Second World War. The telegraph transformed, because it provided instantaneous communication across the world, every institution it came in touch with. And instantaneous communication changes everything. Now, that's Marshall McLuhan. The medium is the message. The man who coined the words global village. When he coined the word global village, which is in 1964, people giggled and said, oh, what a nut. Does anyone argue about a global village today? No one argues about a global village, because we're living in the global village. We have CNN on, Fox News, everything, 7x24. We know it's happening. But it's a little weird, because the global village creates some uneven distribution of information, because I now know more about Angelina Jolie's and Brad Pitt's baby than I do about my nephews. At least in the last week, I know more about them. So we do have a global village, and a global village, just like the chimpanzees and the people that we started with, it's filled with gossip. So now let's talk about the current incarnation of the telegraph, the invention that's changed the world for all of the rest of us. There we go. Now, America was very late to the mobile phone thing. I didn't get a mobile phone until 1999, and my boss ordered me to get one. She said, either you get a mobile phone or we're going to slap a pager on you. And the first time I encountered a culture that was using mobile phones was when I came to Australia in 1996 to speak at a conference. And I was in Sydney, and my friends had called me via landline, I suppose, and said, you know, go to Darling Harbour and meet us at such and such a place and such a time. So I was there at such a place and such a time. And about half the friends that I'd expected to join us were in Darling Harbour at that time. Now, in the before time, that would have meant that we either would have had to sit there and wait for them or go on without them and miss them for the rest of the night. But that's not what happened, because in 1996, that's when Australia got to a 50% penetration of mobile phones. So what's happening now is that all sorts of text messages are going back and forth between the various people. And great, we have a perfectly synchronized, very enjoyable evening. And for me, it was a revelation, because I now understood that all of this coordination could be going on because everyone's got a lot of mobile phones. And the thing that it's given us, the thing we don't even recognize about mobiles anymore, is that no one's late anymore. Because you can always call or send a text, unless you're really rude and trying to piss someone off, or if, God forbid, you're trapped somewhere where you can't get a signal. And we all know what that feels like. There's really nothing more anxious than that. All right. What this tells us is that the mobile phone, all electric technology, but the mobile phone in particular, functions as something like a social hormone. Now, hormones coordinate the tissues of the body. And just the same way that estrogen or adrenaline or testosterone all coordinate the activities of the tissue, mobiles do this for vast numbers of people. Now, have you all heard of something called a flash mob? A flash mob is a situation where a bunch of people, it could be a few tens, it could be a few hundreds, basically all get a text message to be at a certain place at a certain time and do something weird. For example, one of my friends was in a flash mob, she got a text message, go to the Sydney Opera House, to the front steps. She did, with 50 other people, they lined up in two rows as if they were a longboat, sat on the steps and then sang row, row, row your boat, and then dispersed again. Okay. A little silly, a little meaningless, but one of those things that can happen when you can coordinate a whole bunch of people. It's impossible to imagine a flash mob before the mobile phone, and it's absolutely inevitable afterward. And of course, the WTO riots that happened in Seattle in 1999 were, in America's case, the first example of a flash mob, and not exactly a shining example, but that's what starts to happen. And of course, we hear about things like this happening in China, and we know what happened with the Cronulla riots, which were another form of flash mob. Okay, so what are these flash mobs about? At the end of the day, what they're about is participation. Everything that got broken up by industrialization is being stuck back together by electric communication. We are retrieving our ability to participate in the lives of others. That's lovely. However, as we know, participation is not necessarily the same thing as wisdom. It is instead something a little bit different. Participation is potential. It's a potential that we've only just started to learn how to use. But even just what we've learned so far in the last few years has blown away everything we thought before. So, how many of you in this room are not carrying a mobile phone? Okay, so that's probably about 5% of you, I think, maybe, overall. Every mobile phone every computer you sit in front of, even your iPod, all these different things, all these electric devices that are getting more and more and more and more commonplace, every one of them offer an opportunity for participation. And we're rushing headlong into this. And let me just give you, you know, this is not a complete list, this is a brief list. You have blogs where people can post and then share their opinions. You have instant messaging, which sits on your laptop and allows you to talk to people all over the world. You have things like Skype and VoIP, which allow you to make calls freely everywhere on the world. You have SMS, and we all know about SMS. You have podcasts, which this is going to be. We have all these opportunities in all these different ways with all these different media to participate. And none of these existed a decade ago. Possible exception of SMS, not that many people were using it. But today, they're a great big part of our lives. Now why? Well, it's because inside of these, we are each finding our own opportunities to participate, and that opportunity to participate is turning out to be completely irresistible. It's the place where the barn raisings are happening in our modern world, and I want to tell a particular tale about a particular site which is particularly relevant about participation. Now, how many of you do not know about Wikipedia? Okay, so everyone over there is fully knowledgeable, which is cool, and over here it's probably only about 40%. All right, let me explain about Wikipedia. Wikipedia is an edit-yourself encyclopedia. It has entries in it, and you can click on the entry, and if you find that the entry is wrong, you can edit it and change it to something better. Or if you type in a search term and it doesn't return an entry on it, you are invited to create your own entry. And of course, this sounds like it's a recipe for disaster, except that it seems that when you get, as one of my friends put it, enough monkeys at enough keyboards, all of a sudden you get something that is now the third most widely used reference site on the entire internet behind Google and Yahoo. Every 15-year-old in the world who has internet access knows about Wikipedia because they're using it for their term papers. And it shouldn't work. You'd think that if all these people were just sort of coughing up the hairballs of their knowledge and putting it all together, it should just be a mess. But it doesn't work that way because the opportunity to participate also seems to bring out the best in people. It seems that if you're an expert on something, you're probably going to participate in that corner of Wikipedia as opposed to some other corner where you're probably not expert. It seems that that is the way that people are acting toward Wikipedia. And Wikipedia has grown from, I think, when it sort of hung a shingle, 15,000 articles to now, and this number is old. This is a screenshot I took years ago. As of this week, I think there's 1.2 million English language articles in Wikipedia. Now you compare that to Britannica, which we consider the sort of definitive reference in the English language, and there's about 120,000, 130,000 articles in Britannica, so it's now 10 times bigger. But these articles can be on weird pop cultural things that will never show up in Britannica because they're ephemeral. That doesn't make them insignificant. Someone somewhere might want to know about them. And so what's happening with Wikipedia is that through the process of participation, we're basically taking all of the knowledge that's in everyone's heads in the world and putting it into a central repository for everyone to share. And that's changing things. It's changing our relationship to knowledge because all of a sudden we're getting this exterior object which is unlike anything that's ever existed before, which is not only big, but the rate that it's getting bigger is accelerating. It's as if some sort of black hole was sort of sucking everything out of our heads into this one giant consuming ball of human knowledge. This is what barn raising looks like in the 21st century. And it's becoming an unstoppable force. Now, this is just out in the United States. I bought it. I think it'll be coming out in Australia soon. This book is called Revolutionary Wealth. It's by Alvin and Heidi Toffler. You're familiar with the Tofflers, I think, if you've done any sort of reading in future studies at all, since Future Shock and Third Wave are considered sort of absolute foundational works in the field. And the theory in this book is that not only is there a lot of money wealth around in the world, but because people are now openly sharing information as they do with systems like Wikipedia through the process of participation, the amount of wealth in various senses of the word represented by something like this is just exceeding all expectations. And when you drop an object like this into an existing system, for example, how does Britannica compete with this? And eventually, how does a university compete with this? All right, these are the questions that are starting to be asked, and these are the questions they're mentioning in this book. And they're talking about this idea that sharing and collaboration and participation are the potent forms of wealth creation in the 21st century. And I would agree, but again, that wealth creation, I don't mean just money, I mean in terms of human potential, the potential for action, which is how they define wealth. And the pressure to participate is growing because people are finding that they like it and they're trying to participate in more and more different areas. We hear about this vague blogosphere thing, which is often now meant to mean a certain slice of politics, and that certain slice of politics dethroned a major news anchor in America last year. It's probably going to affect political elections both here in Australia during the next electoral cycle, but also in America this year. The participation pressures produced by all of this technology and its invitation to participate are increasing the pressure on all of the institutions that have been built up through the industrial era. So a mining company might want to put a mine somewhere and find themselves blocked by half a dozen NGOs that can work very quickly and very effectively electronically to organize around them. For example, you think the Japanese are going to get away with whaling? I don't think so. All right, and it's not because the nations of the world are going to do anything about it because the Japanese are buying them off. It's because the people of the world are, through participation technology, effectively able to outmaneuver the governments, which is something you need to consider because you guys are a government. And then you have all the educational stuff that's going on. I'm working with any number of now schools and educational organizations in Australia to help them deal with the fact that the kids are well equipped with all this technology and are outmaneuvering the teachers, and they realize that there's a fundamental desynchronization between the way the kids want to learn and the way the industrial age designed schools are giving them their education. And so each of these opportunities to participate are producing pressures on each of the dominant systems that we have, that we're using to organize the world. And there's a problem if that pressure builds up and builds up and builds up and the organizations and the institutions don't effectively adapt to it. And I talked about all the change that's going on here. Well, eventually something snaps. And that's called a revolution. And you don't want a revolution because then you get peasants with, you know, torches and heads on pikes. And that's good for nobody. So I'm assuming that instead of waiting for the systems to crack, because you folks are going to be approached by your constituencies who are using these tools for participation, these tools are going to be used to create effective organizational forms for them. They already are. And the more they use them, the more adept they'll be at using them, and the more they'll be able to organize and to create their own participatory forms, which leaves you, really, with only one reasonable solution, which is that you're going to want to embrace participation. You have to look at that and say, okay, this is what the world is doing. And remember, participation isn't just something that's happening from the outside of your organizations. This is one reason why it's lovely to be in the middle. It's happening within your organizations. That all this participation technology and all these moments for participation are also happening inside your organizations, so that employees, whether they're at the top or the bottom or the middle, will be organizing in their own ways to participate in the process of whatever you do. So, if you want to embrace participation, I just want to give you 3 points. First, I want you to recognize that all of the constituencies out in the world that you're dealing with are already ahead of you on this. They're already doing it. And that's why the first advice is listen to the street. Now, the name of my consultancy is Future Street because we think of the street not as Wall Street, but the street as in what people are already doing out there. The interesting thing about technology is that technology doesn't really reveal itself until a lot of people start perverting it. That's when a technology truly comes into its own. It's when it's doing something completely different than it was intended to. SMS was invented to send emergency messages from the phone company to the users of the phone network. It does happen on occasion, but how many billion SMS messages get sent each day just by people? All right, it's because the street found something for it. So when you're looking for those opportunities to participate, take a look at what people are already doing to participate. Start from that. Once you've got that, redesign your own processes to enable that participation. Redesign your processes for transparency and responsiveness, because that's what someone who wants to participate will be looking for. And then finally, realize that in the era of participation, the burden isn't only on your shoulders. The burden isn't on your shoulders to make all the decisions or to implement all your decisions. You've got to think of this back to the example I gave you about the healthcare system in Tasmania. If we're all going to enter now into a long-term dialogue about the future of carbon production and carbon use in Australia or in America or in Japan, well, okay, you guys get to lead on that, but you will be people participating in a broad social process. All right. So you can make recommendations. Well, this is how we can cut emissions here, or here, or here. This is how we can deal with the fact that the sea level just rose 20 feet, whatever it might be. But the era of participation means that the people who are participating with you want to share the burden. And they're not going to be satisfied until they are convinced they're sharing the burden. But of course, the flip side of that is that they're also sharing the information. Now, technology provides the means for all of this, but it's not what's going on. Technology is simply enabling the desire to participate, but it's not actually the desire itself. And that desire is the thing that's driving us to new institutions in commerce, in government, in education. Now, there's been a lot of talk about what you'll be doing in 20 years' time. In 20 years' time, it's likely that this will all have sorted itself out, that we will have established how participation works in a broadly participative world, where my role as a citizen of a state is to be fully participating in the life of that state. And most of you will still be working in that state. So this isn't theoretical, but it is going to affect the way you work fundamentally. So the question is, are you open to it? Are you willing to participate? Thank you.
Folks, we've still got some time before 5 o'clock, and there's an opportunity here for Mark, and he's quite happy to do this, to take some questions.
Participation should be a relationship. I think it's a kind of relationship, as opposed to saying it's the whole ball of wax. All right, that I am, because the origins of participation lie in this basic idea that I want to have my relatedness with other human beings or other chimpanzees, all right, then there's something that's absolutely common to the desire to participate. In other words, participation is a way of fulfilling a relationship, but it's not exactly the same thing as a relationship, all right? Although I think that we're already starting to see people who are using participation. We've actually always seen people who use participation to fill a void that they don't have because of a relationship. So there's gonna be some confusion there. that confusion is going to get amplified. And, you know, you may have people who think they're sort of dating the government as a result.
What do you see as more important in an effective organization, good relationships or good participation?
I'm not even going to play that. You got to have them both. You have to have them. If you don't have good participation, how are you going to have a good relationship? And if you don't have a good relationship, you can't have good participation. So I don't think of that as that's not an either or. It's we had one of the other talks today, which is, you know, sort of elements of a good relationship, trust and openness and all this stuff. If you've got those, then the moment for participation should appear really naturally. And people will feel that they can invest themselves in a participatory relationship. Back there, yeah.
Do you think that concept of participation that you presented today would be a very viable means in terms of social rehabilitation for what is seen as social outcomes?
Yeah. If you take a look at archaic cultures, they tend to place the damaged individual within a network that allows that person to function at a fairly high level because they're being supported by the rest of the social network. It's not a universal pattern in archaic cultures, but it's a common pattern in archaic cultures. I think we've tried to do this by, you know, even placing individuals like that in the midst of communities. And the question is, could you build and maintain a strong enough social network around it? It's a technique that's probably going to work, but again, this is something it's going to take years to sort of understand how to make that work for all of the stakeholders, all of the people involved in that relationship. All right. I mean, given the nature of the aging population, even if we manage to delay the sort of senescence for some period of time, we're going to have more aging people than a healthcare system can deal with. So that means that there's going to be a participatory relationship around dealing with the aged. And maybe that's the first place we'll start to say, we absolutely need to do it in this way because none of the existing systems are going to be capable of shouldering that burden. Well, yeah, I mean, we're going to have to learn how to balance all of that. We already have something similar to this. One of the reasons that I breathe a sigh of relief every time I'm back in Australia is because Australia is not over-mediated. America is completely over-mediated. You know, turned on the telly on Monday night and there was nothing on, and I was really kind of psyched about that because that's never the case in America because I've got 70 channels and I'll always be able to waste time on something. We are going to have to learn how to moderate our interests and our interest level. And does participation mean that you're participating for the rest of your life in something, or does it mean that you're dropping in for a month? Does it mean that you're trying to participate in everything that you're interested in or knowing because you understand your own capabilities and your own attention span, all right? These are skills that ancient cultures didn't need because there weren't that many different things to participate in. They're skills that were never used during the industrial era, so they're skills we're gonna have to develop. I'm sorry, no, it's all right, he had his hand up. Okay, I'm sorry, the basic question, 100 words or less, when you're dealing with the various socioeconomic castes of the world, will participation work in an effective way to prevent the abuse of basically of one caste by another? My feeling, my gut feeling is, and I think I'm being at least a little bit Pollyanna-ish and optimistic about this, is that the participatory organization of people who are dedicated to ideals of social justice will go to some length to remedy them. The problem being that the individuals who are motivated by other things will also use the same forms of participatory organization. Now, the question here, and this comes back to this whole question about relationship, people who are doing it purely for financial gain may not have the same heart in it as people who are doing it because they're fighting for reasons of social justice. This is the reason that we've had a constant advance of social justice for the last 300 or 400 years, because they've just kept at it longer, they've participated longer. In the end, it gives those groups an amplified power of participation. That's probably a good thing. Is that all right? Okay, so we had one, yeah.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to ask, how do you go about moderating the participation? Like when you talk about Wikipedia,
yeah.
Having recently heard of an organization using Wiki.
Right. This is where you have to walk very carefully, because you have to walk a line between the fact that they require no moderation at all and the fact that they can spiral out of control if they have no moderation. The best approach is always to have an extremely light touch and almost like a slumber party full of 9-year-olds only intervene when things are out of control. Otherwise, you're sort of, it doesn't mean that they don't know you're never there. You should sort of be this benevolent force that only sweeps in when things have gotten completely messed up, which is basically how Wikipedia works. Now, Wikipedia is evolving standards that are making it both more acceptable as an academic resource, like they're getting citations all over the place. They used to not have citations. Now they're on a citation drive. So all the articles are getting citations. But they're also on a drive about what it means to be an editor of a page. Can I be anonymous and be the editor of a page? Okay, well, yeah, maybe I can do that, but can I do that with every page? Well, some pages you can't be anonymous and edit. For instance, George Bush's page. All right, they will not let you anonymously. So the other side of it is that participation is it's an evolving process. And so the people who are participating have to understand that the thing they're starting out with isn't necessarily the thing they're ending up with, because they're going to learn through the process of participation what the ground rules are. Yes.
Sort of a combination of the, I guess, the themes of the day, the name of your company here, FutureStream and so on. Can you look another 10 years out? You're talking about technologies that we're using today to participate.
Right.
Could you provide some comment on, say, in 10 years' time, what you see we might be using and the impact that might have on it?
How long you got? I sort of stayed away from that because I wanted to talk about something that was, in a sense, relevant to you, is the fact that governments are about people and this is where the people are going. I'll give you sort of some headlines. You're going to use your mobile phone about an order of magnitude more than you do now, and it's going to make you an order of magnitude less crazy than it does now. Okay. We love our mobile phones and we hate our mobile phones. And that's because they're remarkably dumb for being something that is so completely vital to us. They are remarkably dumb. And they're going to start to get a lot smarter. What they're doing is they're going to start to act as an interface between you and your social world. Not as something that, well, something that may block it when you want it to be blocked, but something that functions as a very sort of carefully orchestrated middle layer, because it's always with you. It's with you when you meet people in the flesh, and it's with you when you meet people on the phone or when you're texting them or whatever. And right now, the phone's not really doing anything about that. Okay, so that's one level of where it's going. Another level of where the world is going is that if you think there's a lot of media around in the world today, you ain't seen nothing yet. All right? A 15-year-old is already living in a world that is saturated beyond anything that I'm probably capable of comprehending, and I do a lot of work in media. But that's now amplifying because it's now become completely transparent for a single person on a single computer anywhere in the world to send a great big movie that they've made to everyone in the world for no cost. And so that means there's going to be a lot more information flying around, a lot more visual imagery, just a lot more media in general. And so the important thing in that sea of media is not, oh wow, I can get absolutely anything everyone ever made ever, and all the copyrighted music and the record companies are upset. No, it's not about that. It's how do I turn it down? All right, so that the skills are going to be the filtering skills and the editing skills, and people will and are actually already starting to make a living being editors, DJs, whatever you want to call them, providing lists of things. Boing Boing, which is the most popular blog in the world, if you've ever heard of it, has 2 million subscribers. Boing Boing is a directory of wonderful things, and it's not about any particular thing, although it sort of has a technological bent and a slightly geeky, cool, but hip bent, right? But all they do is they sort of go through all of the stuff in the universe and will give you 50 posts a day on stuff that you might actually want to look at, which for me is an invaluable service, because I actually spend 3 to 4 hours online a day reading, just keeping caught up in my own field. And so that's where we're going, is that we are, as individuals and as communities, are going to develop our own tools, and some of that's going to be participatory. You have something now called DIG. DIG is a website where the readers of it vote the stories that get onto the front page by giving it a thumbs up or not. You either get a thumbs up or you don't do anything at all. And so it's a collaborative news filter. So this is, the front page of DIG is collectively what the readers of DIG think is important. All right. So there's a lot of different, and that, you know, that's participation, but that's just a little bit of participation. It's really easy for me to participate in that way, as opposed to, say, Boing Boing. If I were one of the editors of Boing Boing, I'd be reading things constantly so I could turn out nugget after nugget in somewhat predigested form to the readers. Okay, those are two. And I think, are we?
I think we are.
Okay, thank you all very much.